McDonald. I've been at Microsoft off and on. First time was back in 76 as the first employee, and the little picture is there, which gives you a nice segue.
All right, who are you in this? So this is the...
I'm the guy with the beard and the glasses. I'm this guy here. Started back in April of 76, and then originally doing P code interpreter for, what was it, 6502. And I've been working on BASIC, then did a thing called standalone BASIC, which used this file system some people have heard of called the FAT. Then did common command scanner for, at that time we had Fortran and the assembler were our products. So I did a common command scanner for them because I always like tools, you know, make it easier for people to do things. Then, let's see. Linker assembler, then 8086 original assembler, then did a conversion program to convert from 8080 code to 8086 assembler code to simplify people's work. Actually, something way back was original too, which was kind of interesting.
Let's come in your office, yeah.
Which was when we originally did BASIC, we had tons and tons of conditionals for all the different manufacturers we were selling it to. And so we'd have all these conditionals, you know, and eventually we'd say, okay, well, we'd sell the source code to various manufacturers, too. They just liked the comfort of having the source code. Well, they didn't want all those conditionals, and so I wrote a program where you'd tell it, okay, this is what's defined, and it would go automatically through all that and get rid of all the conditionals that end up being true or false in all the code bodies so the code would look much better than it really was for people.
And what are you doing today?
What I'm doing today is called Windows Defect Prevention. We originally started out as trying to take root cause analysis, which we found to be very valuable for Windows to try to find the root causes of bugs and then prevent them early instead of deal with them later. But that was a really expensive process that it would take months for someone to go through 100 or so bugs and figure out what the root cause was. So our original charter was to find some way to scale that up. And in doing that, we looked at a bunch of different techniques. We looked at root cause analysis. We looked at failure mode and effects analysis. And we looked at a guy called James Reason, who did a lot of analysis of the ways people make mistakes, what kind of errors people make, and why. And then we also found a thing called orthogonal defect classification from IBM. And that's a statistical way to determine where your problems are. So what it is you would had a limited set of about five or six categories you would categorize a bug by, and the most important one that's the easiest one to give an example was functional error, which meant, oh, I forgot something. You know, I forgot an interface of some kind. I can't do this for some reason. And so what you could take as a simple thing is that, well, if you think you're close to release and you're getting a lot of functional problems, you're not close to release.
No.
And in fact, your solution is you've got to go back and look at your original designs and fix things. So it gives you that signal to go back. So what I've done is come up with something called a defect taxonomy, which is a vast expansion of that, bringing in some of Reason's human error analysis. Because after all, you know, it's easy to say, you know, blame the developer. Oh, you made a mistake. Bad you. When really it can be caused by a lot of different reasons. It could be the processes being done. It could be the knowledge that people are getting is just too hard to find, and that's particularly a case with the scale of Windows, the number of developers, the number of features, the amount of information you need to know. Can't know everything, and so knowledge access needs to be a priority. And then there are, even in when someone does make a mistake that's on their part, there's things that can be done about it. And so the taxonomy, for instance, divides things up into saying, well, okay, you've got the information that someone was gathering to decide what the problem was and what to do about it. Then you would have the analysis that they went through to find out the nature of the problem.
Is it possible to make a perfect piece of software?
It's possible to make a lot better software, but perfect is based on the definition. What's perfect? It's like proving correctness. Okay, it does what you say, but is what you say right? You can't tell that. That's kind of another axis.
Well, isn't software a creative endeavor, like taking a photograph or drawing a picture or writing a great poem? Or
it's the way I've phrased it in some papers is saying software is making dreams reality. Then in a way what we're doing is we're taking someone's idea, some users or customers or something, this is what we want to be able to do, and turning that into reality. And that's a translation process. You're going from this nebulous idea to a more concrete expression of the idea, and then you're starting to put it in the code. And so all these are translations. Every time you have a translation, you can have an error, and you can lose information. So that what you knew at this level just isn't expressible at the level below that. And when you run into that problem, you get in a lot of self-invented problems or can't get there from here. The example I always use is Excel, that when you paste a formula across cells, somebody said 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. Well, it's easier just to transpose that formula and put it on all the cells. But if you remembered the formula in the range, that gives you a lot more power. These are other scenarios you might not have considered. Oh, I want to change the formula that applies over this range. I want to know what formulas apply to what cells. You can't answer those questions once you've made that first translation and lost the information.
Yeah. Come on in your office.
Yeah, these are some cards just for fun. You can zoom in on the business cards. That is the first Microsoft card. That's the first Microsoft company card.
Wow.
Then Asymmetrics was the next company. Design Intelligence was where I was at before I came here 5 years ago.
And you have just a standard old office. They don't give you anything special. You know?
Yeah, actually.
Oh, you don't have a view of a parking lot like some people do.
I got a view of a lawn. I got a view of the lunchroom. I can go out and see what it looks like out there. A funny thing was when I came back, there was this thing about trying to get me the number one, the employee number one. And it's funny from the mail thing is because there's like, I think there was probably 5 or a half dozen or more people involved in this. First, there was discussion between Bill and Steve. Well, should it be one or should it be two? You know, and Bill gets asked, but you know, he was always there. You know, Bill's it. So it was okay with Bill for me to be number one. You know, if I went literally, you know, I'm 2 or 3, depending on whether or not you include Paul at this point. But then it was on the kind of the HR side, you know, okay, get him employee number one. And, of course, the underlying accounting system for all that stuff will not let you create a number.
Yep.
It only gives you the numbers you are. So after all this, they couldn't do it. So we came up with the elegant solution, or I came up with the elegant solution, is I got extra fronts printed, and I just scratched off everything but the first digit. And with a little whiteout. Yeah, that was funny because all these people getting involved, and it just wasn't possible. Again, it's a scenario they didn't envision in the software itself. And that's kind of what always happens, you know, when you're doing...
You said you came back. Why did you come back?
Well, I was at a company called Design Intelligence, and what we were doing there was adaptive document design. So this was where the document designer could describe his design, and we would do, quote, the right thing, unquote, under changing the content, different number of pictures, different aspect ratios of pictures, different text, amount of text, different anchor points throughout the text, and then deliver it to the web or print or different page sizes and still satisfy the designer. And it's one part of the real learning experience in that is that the designer's life is that result. That's how he's judged what that looks like. And so that's why they're very fine. Those things. Well, not this font, that font. Well, not 8 point. 8.3 is better. And the leading should be, you know, just 0.2 of a point bigger than that. Oh, I want to expand the kerning by 0.5% between characters. But they're very precise sometimes. And you're asking them to give up that control. So in order to do that, you've got to understand their concepts and reflect them. That's something on my customer focus side that really reinforced. I could come up with the most elegant technical way to do layout or positioning or font sizing or anything. If they didn't grok it, it don't fly.
Yeah.
You know, you have to satisfy that customer because you've got to get their buy-in, and you're not going to get it if you do things that surprise them. And so least astonishment is what you needed to do. And that meant the hard part of what you would call doing an expert system, understanding the expert, their concept. So I would spend hours and hours and days with designers saying, okay, well, let's talk about this particular issue, you know, say emphasis and say, okay, fine. You know, and you might think emphasis is just size. Well, yeah, is it width? Is it height? Change the aspect ratio, screws up. Black and white versus color. Position on the page. Does it have a border? How much white space is around? All those things affect emphasis. And yet, you know, as a developer, you might think, it's just size.
Yep.
And you wouldn't satisfy a designer if you did that. You had to give them their way to describe what they particularly decided emphasis meant so that it could work correctly. And so this was a lot of fun getting inside their mind, learning new things, and very much reinforces this thing. You know, you've got to listen to your customers. You've got to figure out how they do things. Because if you can keep it simple, stupid, if you can keep it a nice one-to-one conceptual match, you get satisfaction. You limit frustration. And a lot of times it turns out to be easier to do than some contorted thing that you would do otherwise.
Right. So, how did you come to Microsoft the first time?
I came the first time I was at UW just taking some miscellaneous courses, and I got a call from this guy, you know, that I was doing computers with in high school. His name was Bill. He said, hey, come down to Albuquerque and work for $8.50 an hour. I said, ah, well, maybe. So I drove down to Albuquerque, and let's see, at that point, only Paul had an office at MITS. I had a part of a table in the general machine room. We all stayed in one apartment, 1180 Alvarado. I don't remember the apartment number. And we were using teletypes with paper tape, and 16K was a lot of memory. That was the big thing. Oh, wow, 16K static card. Ooh, better than those 4K dynamics. No floppy disks yet, just getting into floppy disks, 8-inch.
Did you guys have any clue what this industry was going to become?
I don't think so. There was a book some time ago that the title was great, the content wasn't. It was Accidental Millionaires in a way. It was just right place, right time, right idea, and good business follow through. You got to give Bill the credit that, you know, seeing the business aspects and going through that. And at times it was very deceptive because he looked so young. So he'd be talking to these companies, you know, to sell him something. They thought they could pull something over on him, and there's no way. So in a way, he probably played that a little bit in the early years to his advantage. But yeah, you know, it started out, we just had BASIC. And we had to fight to get that away from MITS and Pertec. And so then we had BASIC. And then we actually, wow, we moved into our own offices in a bank building in Albuquerque, to Park Central Tower, as I recall. And then we actually hired some other people and worked on our next big project, Fortran, for the 8080. And hired a couple people to do that. And then we did COBOL, if anybody remembers, for the 8080. And
what's your favorite time in that? What's your favorite memory of that time?
That's tough. You know, the first NCC was kind of fun because it was in New York, and it was there wasn't, you know, like there is now, that it's all personal computers kind of thing. You're off in a corner somewhere. So it was kind of, you know, first getting in there. It was also fun because you'd be dealing very directly with the companies, the companies that are doing things. So it would be very much kind of a one-to-one relationship between you and some company who's buying BASIC, for instance. Or there was a real explosion of standalone disk BASIC I thought was really nice, since I did the standalone part. And I kept making it simpler and simpler for any OEM or us to interface it. So it got down to where, okay, well, all you have to do is fill in this address for a function, and it needs to do these five things, and you're done. Your disk works. And so there were just dozens of Japanese computers at that point that ran BASIC and graphics, that we had our first graphics BASIC then. And so there were just always companies coming in. So that was fun, too, because we had this big room, and it would have, 20, 30, 40 different manufacturers' computers on them, mostly Japanese, all, you know, standalone BASIC or whatever, over these tables. So it was a lot of fun at that point, you know, have all these companies coming in and doing things for them.
I don't even know where to start. It's like, this was 1976, right?
Yeah, this is 76 to, say, 76 to, oh,
I was 81. In junior high.
Yeah.
You know, I had a tour of Apple Computer when they were one building back in 77. You know, and you guys were working in Albuquerque probably back then. What's the most surprising thing that you didn't foresee?
Oh, that's pretty easy. The size of, you know, what Microsoft turned into. When I left Microsoft was '84, spring, January '84 is when I left. At that time, we were in pretty much one building down on Northup.
Yeah. you know, in Bellevue.
Yeah. And they were, you know, 400 people. It was getting pretty big, you know. It's getting too big for me. I'd rather be a little more direct and stuff. And so I left then. And so then when I came back here, and it's like, okay, you know, one of these buildings holds more people than were there when I left. And there's many more than one. And the network has, you know, thousands and thousands of people on it. Just the scale of everything is really incredible when you come back into it from when I left.
Yeah.
It's just...
When did you come back?
I came back in December of 2000. They bought the company I was at, Design Intelligence, and that's how I came back. So we were originally working on adaptive layout and WinFX.
Got it.
And so one little part of that was demoed back at the PDC then, which was the resizable window with the columns changing and the sizes of the picture. That was our code.
Awesome.
And that's just the smallest, simplest step along the axis of adaptive layout. That was comparatively primitive compared to what you can do.
Do you have a unique view of the future because you've been in the industry for so long? Or?
Well, there's some, you know, kind of looking technically is, I know how little we started with, you know, how little power, how little memory, how little disk space, and I look at what we've got now, you know, compared to an 8080 running at, you know, 1-2 megahertz, that's with an M, and having, you know, ooh, wow, 64K max, and I compare that now to gigabytes and 3-plus gig process, multiprocessors, and it's such a change, and yet, in a way, I think a lot of people don't realize what that power can be used for. In a way, it gets sucked up by graphics. But there's so much more we could do to, you know, address our customers, to make things easier for them, to rethink our software. Because you've got the processing power, you've got the memory. Let's use it as opposed to, you know, adding the next little feature to something and still keeping the same metaphor. Because there's a thing when you look at, you know, you try to... figure out what customers want, then in a way they're a corrupted sample.
Yep.
That they don't know what computers can do. They know what this program does, so they think of what's possible in those terms, and it's not revolutionary. It's not really a big step.
An ex-boss said, if you ask a Porsche customer what they want, they'll ask for more headroom, more trunk space, mm-hmm. a smoother ride. Well, they just designed a Volvo, right?
A lot of times
asking the customer what they want is the wrong way to approach it.
Right. That's the thing. You've got to understand the customer. So, for instance, tablet PC, great thing. You know, I love where on the tablet you can have your paper and you say, I need more room here, and stretch it out, and I've got more blank space. Something you can't do on paper, but something you wish you could. Now, if you were just being faithful to paper, you wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
But if you think back saying, well, how often are you, you know, writing something? Oh, I got to put some stuff in here. And you write small or you do the big line out to something. And says, well, gee, why don't we just give them more room? We can do that. It's a computer. It's not real paper. There's an example of where you're thinking back to what your customer needs to do as opposed to the immediate thing you might have got from them. Because if you ask them, you know, you ask 100 customers, you know, of tablet, would they say, do I need to stretch paper? No. But if you told them, hey, you can stretch paper, oh, yeah, I want that. Same thing with this thing with, you know, a formula range in Excel. You know, I could probably survey 1,000 Excel users and none of them would suggest that. But if I put that on the item, probably all of them would suggest that.
Yep.
And that's the thing. That's where you kind of need people who can get out, understand a customer, really try to bring those concepts and values to themselves, and yet be technically aware enough and with enough depth to know what's possible, because that's the trade-off. You know, you're trying to figure out, okay, what do they want versus what can I do? And that's fun. You know, that's one piece of fun to me is that, and the other piece of fun is, you know, when you're talking about is it possible to write error-free software, is making it harder to make errors.
Yeah.
Axes on that, some of the things are already being done at Microsoft and can be done much more, is, for instance, static test tools. You know, tools that go over your code and find some of the obvious kinds of errors you can make.
Yeah. Looking for things like buffer overruns and stuff.
Yeah, there's buffer overruns. They're trying to get some things for some security problems, you know, because what you've got when you consider translation process, our whole kind of process when you look at a normal software development, you've got these review cycles.
Yeah.
Those are all human. Because they're all human, there's a possibility for error. So the way you try to catch the errors is Swiss cheese. Okay, we'll review it here, now we'll review it here, now we'll review it here, and we'll run some tests, you know, and you're hoping through the gauntlet to catch the problem. But it's kind of because the reason you have a manual review in the first place is because what you're comparing against is a manual artifact.
Yeah.
It's a document. It's a spec. It's not code. It can't be automatically compared. And so getting more information, being able to embellish static tools with that information, they can then check for a lot more things than they do now. And that's one part. Another part is, of course, you know, really doing much more before you write a line of code than you do now. Sometimes lip service is spent to it. Sometimes people actually do go through all the detail. But you really don't have structures set up to make that easy. So it's kind of, you know, thinking of tools that can make it easy for someone to kind of have a machine usable design and feature set and work that all the way through. And we're doing some things with that with other groups are doing some things with that, and MSR and others, to try to come up with some things along that area. And it's all trying to reduce error. I kind of view the last step, you know, that step from when you take your code and you put it into C++ or C#, that's a huge translation loss. Yeah. You lose so much in making that step. And that's where, you know, embellishing information with code comes in, is to try to pull you back from that. Because a lot of errors are self-created at that point. It's not an error in the spec. It's that error in the implementation. It's an error in implementation because you thought of one scenario and there's actually three.
Yep.
Or you just made a mistake.
Yep. Where else? What are you proudest of in Windows Vista? That's coming with. What's the thing you're going to show your friends?
Well, it depends on the friend. Usually, the usual thing you can show on the friends is, you know, the new fancy glass and transparency interface. You know, that's the most flashy thing that's there. When we kind of scale back because we bit off more than we could chew for Vista, we did some things to increase the quality. Because, and this is a problem of scale again, you know, is that Windows is so large on almost every axis, the number of developers, the number of testers, the size of the code, the number of features, the number of different groups building the code and trying to merge their changes in, the number of customers, the number of hardware devices, the number of applications running on it, it's all so vast. And you need to try to get some better control on that. And so one thing we've got is things called quality gates, which is kind of a second look before a feature gets into the main lab to make sure that it's of high quality. Because one thing we were finding before is people would check, get things up in the main lab, and then a lot of people would get problems from it, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes it would be that, you know, feature A depends on feature B, and they would integrate back up with the main lab, and then they could be tested. But unfortunately, a lot of people see that, and so you wanted to get it. No, we want to get that, you know, down and isolated and make sure it works before we bring it up to the main lab. And that, in a way, is controlling our quality a good bit better than the situation before the formation of the core operating systems group to kind of focus on the core of Windows. The formation of the group I'm in called Windows Defect Prevention is to kind of take a look. Again, it's the scale thing. It's so big. You know, there's no way you can do root cause analysis on every bug. Is to try to look at things at the scale of Windows, the processes, the education, the training we have, the tools we have. You know, trying to look for areas where we can make things better.
Yeah, you don't have
fun.
To. Why is it fun? What? Because you obviously don't need. I'm assuming you don't need to work, right?
Oh no, I need to.
Not for
work.
The version
I
that
left,
I. Did.
I left when I was half. I was left when I was half vested. I'm comfortable, so I'm not. I'm not comfortable.
But still, Bill and Steve don't need to work for the reasons I need to work for.
Yeah,
right. What drives you guys? What,
but
what?
I do. I do have the advantage that you know, in some ways, I'll shake the boat, you know, in various ways, saying, hey, you know. So common sense can be important, and so what's got me enthusiastic is that I look, you know, sometimes developers are very much, you know, they want to do the feature is the thing. And, you know, after you've been around for a few years, in my case almost 30 doing this stuff, you come to value, you know, what gets out to the customer, say the DI experience, dealing with the designers and things before.
What's the DI experience?
Design intelligence. That's what I was talking about, the document designers and that, you know, needing to understand them in order to do what you need to do. You know, you can't do it if they don't buy it. Really reinforced that viewpoint. And So I very much view much more, you know, the whole process from, you know, getting what the customers need, what features we want to release, all the way out to getting it released, supporting it, testing it, all this. You know, it's that whole process I want to get an impact on, not just, you know, I implemented this feature. And so I look and say, hey, this is a place where I can get the most leverage in what I do. You know, if I can save, you know, if I can make it so, you know, 1% or a fraction of 1% of the bugs or less, you know, that don't occur from what I do, that's huge. If I can save 15 minutes out of a developer's day, that's huge when you have thousands of developers. If I can prevent, you know, some customers from running, you know, with the number of customers, prevent 100,000 customers from running into a problem because you've caught it early because of some process you've set up or some information you spread out, great. You know, it's just the huge dividend. The leverage is huge. And we've done, we're actually starting on this internally, and with the usual provisor, should eventually be available at least to beta people. So I'm going to call a scenario site, which is listing a bunch of Windows scenarios where our internal user base, for instance, can rank them.
Yeah.
You know, did it work well? Did I like it? Is it important to me? To really get that kind of metric information back, and then we want to be able to get that information back from our beta sites too, so that we can see, you know, what do the customers find is good, as opposed to what we, you know, if we're thinking as developers, think is good. Because say what I think as a developer really doesn't count.
Yeah.
It's what the customers think, and they aren't developers, and so I have to put myself into their mindset, or I have to, you know, be upgrading my machine at home and swearing a lot.
What kind of employees? How is the employee that Microsoft and software industry needs, because you've done both here and elsewhere, and how is that different from, like, the 1970s? Is there a different kind of software developer needed today, or a different kind of skill set that... Where would you be investing if you were a college kid going to college? What would you be focusing on, maybe? That's the question.
Well, I think, you know, in development, I think that, you know, a lot of people are a little too narrow in coming out as far as, you know, kind of what languages they've been exposed to and programmed in. So if, you know, they've done Java, C#, C++, those are all really similar languages. They're all compile, link, execute languages. They all are not very far away from assembly language. You know, they've done some nice things for it. You don't have to worry about the registers and doing your expressions, you know. But conceptually, they don't really add much innately on top of the underlying processor. Then you have class libraries, and you add things that way. But sometimes if you, you know, want to do something that's a little different than the class library, you're back at square one. And so, to me, wider exposure to different languages that have different techniques. So in my case, languages like Lisp and Prolog, they have kind of a different mindset and concept about a lot of the ways they do things and the functionality they provide. And if you have those, then those techniques can still be used in languages like C# or C++. But if you haven't been exposed to them, you don't even think that way.
Yeah.
So it's kind of saying you want broader knowledge of some of the concepts in programming that are in different languages, and get in touch with the customer. You know, you can be too narrowly thinking of code and algorithms and this and that. You got to realize you got to value all the other people besides the developers, because, you know, somebody from user experience, user interface expert, security expert, somebody who knows this kind of customer, they all can have very valuable input, because it's the different dimensions of looking at a problem. The more dimensions you can look at something and get that hammered out first, say, oh, gee, I hadn't thought of that. Okay, that'll be this. Or, oh, no, that won't work.
Yeah.
You know, getting that, valuing everybody's opinion, and using that to do a better job and getting it up front, instead of saying, well, we don't need to listen to them. They're not developers.
Yeah.
That's not good. And so I think very much as a developer, you want to really kind of broaden your horizons very much towards the customer and in the breadth of language technologies and other technologies you look at and what you learn, because that makes you someone who can fill a number of roles and can talk to a number of people and get information out of them that you wouldn't be able to otherwise.
Yeah. You said you went to high school with Bill?
Mm-hmm.
So you worked on the traffic data?
Yeah, that's actually fairly far in. That was mainly after, I think it was about 73.
If you walked in right now, what would you guys talk about?
Long time no see. Exchange some emails, but we haven't managed to get together to really talk. There's there are a lot of kind of company you know, issues. It'd be interesting to see his viewpoints. The same kind of thing I'm doing, you know, with this defect prevention is, you know, okay, I'm looking at it from this end of the pipe, yeah, as to, you know, what I'm seeing in interviewing groups and looking at processes and procedures and looking at bugs and seeing what kinds of errors we're having and such. But then there's also the whole other end of the pipe. You know, what are they seeing at Bill and Steve's end of the pipe as their view and what they see as problem and such? And so to kind of get that intersection, because that's the other problem is, you know, when you're dealing with a company this size, you know, it's like, okay, fine, you know, Bill, Steve, Jim Alchin, Brian Valentine, you know, they can send an email out to everybody. You know, downward communication can work, but you don't want to use it too much because it's going to overflow people. You know, if you're getting, you know, daily mails from to everybody across the company, it'd be too much. But upward communication is tough because you want to be Bill and get, you know, oh, gee, send me some mail if you have some interest in this problem. Okay, 40,000 emails later, you know, how do you get through 40,000 emails? So when you're dealing with the scale we have, there's this problem of up communication.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you're going up by layer, you're going to get, again, translation loss. Every time you're going up a layer, you're doing a translation or an abbreviation of what was said, and so you can lose information. And so that's kind of a real problem with big organizations is, yeah, you can broadcast, but this reverse pipe is difficult.
Isn't that what's really interesting about blogging?
Yeah, that it does give, you know, someone down at the leaf a means to get out there to everybody, and hopefully, you know, somebody from the top might actually occasionally look too. But yeah, it's closing these cycles. It's, you know, it's getting customer feedback. It's getting feedback from, you know, the people at the other end of the pipe, that if you can close some of these loops, you're a better company for it. Because it's information you just might not know, or might not know the nuance of, or the effect of something you've done, or what's really going on down there. And it just gets bigger and bigger just based on the huge size of Microsoft. Okay. You know, it's different than, you know, when I left, a big project was about 5 people.
Wow.
It was called Interface Manager. Later it was called Windows. You know, typical project, 1 or 2 people. Now you look, a feature has more than that on it. And so it's a huge change in scale, but, you know, in a lot of ways, most of the procedures are similar to when you were smaller, and they just don't work so well. They have their own problems. They have their own self-created problems that you've kind of outgrown the mechanisms you've used. And so my personal opinion is, yeah, that's part of the thing to think about. You know, how can I think of ways to try to address those kind of problems, too?
Yeah. Interesting. Any other interesting stories from the early days?
There are ones out there about racing around, which, of course, we did.
Yeah.
Albuquerque. It was unfair. Bill had the 911. Paul had a Chevy Monza, which was a... I can't remember the affectionate term I had on it for it, but basically it had no weight in the back, so that whenever you took a turn, it would swing out. And I had a Saab Sonnet at that point, and I had front-wheel drive, and I only weighed 1,800 pounds, so I was 1,000 pounds lighter, but Bill had the horsepower, so only if there was a lot of current turns could I have any chance at all. God, we did too much eating at Denny's. one or two in the morning. you know, I think they say, you know, we had 3 of us in 1 2-bedroom apartment in Albuquerque when Bill was down. So, and we had, we later moved and got a house with about 4 bedrooms. That was a lot better.
Wow. But so the whole dev team was in one house?
Pretty much, yeah. That was it. You know, at the beginning, it was you were low overhead. You know, didn't have a lot of income.
And how old were you guys at that time?
Let's see, 20, so 76, 20? Yeah. So I was 19 and 20, so Bill's a year older than me, so he's 21, and Paul is 2 than that, so he was around 23.
Yeah.
So yeah, early 20s, down in Albuquerque, a town where if you drive 5 minutes, you're out. And it's in the desert, a town where it was 95 degrees and 5% humidity in the summer, which was okay, and then it got down to like 10 degrees, 5 to 10 degrees in the winter, and that was a little less okay when my gas line froze. And I ended up walking all the way back to the house one day and got, you know, had icicles on my mustache from the from just my exhalation. It was so cold out there.
Yeah. Is it true that Bill finished the BASIC on the plane going in? Or debug the code, or found some problem in the code.
See, I'm trying to remember because that was I was like 5 months before me, but I know there was some marathon sessions before going down to MITS because it was kind of like saying, "Oh, we've got this basic." I says, "Oh, good. I think we should start working on it." No, they'd actually done a good bit then, and they'd got it there. And yeah, I think there was, I don't remember if there was one bug or not, but, you know, the story is, it actually got up to say, okay, and you can print, you know, 2+2, you know, off the tape. Oh, it was the bootloader. That's what was written on the plane. Something to load it, because this came down on paper tape. Remember, no discs yet. So it was paper tape, and it was, I think it was Paul, and he was writing the bootloader for the paper tape on the plane going down to Albuquerque. And then you would have to key it in. The Altairs, you had the regular computer console, so you could enter code through the switches, you know, and you had the lights and all that. So it was putting the bootloader in to load the BASIC. That's what was being written on the plane.
Wow. I can't even imagine that kind of world where...
The scale is so different. That's where I kind of look and I say, well, I came from that, and now I look at what we have, and I say, God, we can do so much better. You know, we can, it's the same kind of thing. You know, if you do something at one point, it might be fine for that point in time. Then time passes, technology, knowledge increases. You want to revisit.
Yeah. Well, the office team just redesigned the office formats for the same reason. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, some of the reasons they did those formats was to fit on a
drive. The example I use is the FAT file structure. I designed that thing back when there were 8-inch floppy disks. The whole disk held 360K, 76 tracks, I think that's right, 76 tracks, actually 77, of 26 sectors of 128 bytes. So when I designed that thing, and they were slow and we had limited memory, so off those five things, I designed the FATs. It was 152 bytes represented the entire disk structure and all the linking information in that one little table, and one track for the directory, and then I had some sectors left over, so I put out three copies of the FAT there for redundancy, and that filled the track out, and fine. And I made it configurable. You know, I actually did a little operating system that never saw the light of day that, you know, went up to 16-bit FAT entries. But the thing is, you know, all those assumptions were correct for the time, and they lasted for a good while, but about when the XT came out with the 10-meg hard disk, they're really obsolete. You know, you need to revisit and say, hey, do these conditions still hold? Have we learned nothing? Is there nothing new that would affect our design decisions? But the kind of cross problem you have on that is compatibility with something the size of Windows. You go and change something, and who are you going to hit? You know, what's not going to work anymore? And what you run into then sometimes is, okay, we'll keep this and we'll have the new thing too. Now you've got more code because you're supporting two different systems. You're hoping they don't interfere with each other in any way so that if somebody starts and half changes their code, well, we'll use some of the new stuff and we'll use some of the old stuff too, for instance. You hope they don't have problems with each other. This is a kind of a can of worms you get by keeping that, but that's compatibility forces you into that.
Yeah.
And so I mean, a real dilemma, you know, as to how you can really, you know, do new, better things or replace things with far better constructions than you had before while maintaining compatibility. Yeah. Sometimes you kind of hope that, you know, things, the application dies its death over so many years and you don't have to worry about it anymore. You know, the time solves problem. Yeah, it's a real issue. Again, it's because of the size of the market. You've got over 500,000 customers. You've got, I forget what the number was, tens of thousands of hardware devices that plug in, you know, probably equivalent number of applications, if not two or three times that. So you've got this huge compatibility requirements. So it's a real issue to try to balance those. But it's technology is changing fast. You know, it's not so much processor speed now, but you know, it's changing quickly. Things are getting cheaper that used to be expensive. Speeds are going up in places where speeds didn't go up before.
Yeah, and graphics cards are amazing now.
I mean, yeah, graphics cards, disk capacity.
I was saying Windows Vista needs a beefy video card, and somebody said, what are you talking about? A beefy video card today is $70 with 128 megs of RAM.
You know? It's a low-end card that's beefy enough kind of thing. You know, oh, you want a high-end card. Well, that's something entirely, you know, so much more powerful than what's required. And that's just a hardware advantage. Say, you know, now I can, you know, I was just looking, you know, I can get a 300 gigabyte SATA Seagate drive down at Fry's, you know, for $119. Yeah. I used to spend $200 for 2 gigabytes.
Yep.
And that was a bargain then. You look at the speeds and the size, you know, it's this radical change.
Yeah.
And then again, it comes back, you know, with radical changes like that, you're assuming it doesn't affect, you know, what you've got done, and it does.
Yeah. If you had to do it all over again, if you were a 19-year-old kid, what would you be doing today?
Doing today as opposed to if I did anything different in the past?
Today. Would you be working at a small startup again, or would you?
I've done three. Say, I did Microsoft. That was a small startup. I'm the first employee anywhere I go. So I was Microsoft's first employee. I was Asymmetrix's first employee. I was Design Intelligence's first employee.
And Asymmetrix is a pretty big company now, too, right?
I think they're kind of medium.
Okay.
They're not that big.
Okay.
They're clicked
over
now.
But they're not eight people.
Yeah, they're bigger than eight people. Almost any company gets bigger, you know, than eight people. DI, we're bigger than eight people. But startups can be fun, and it's there's kind of, you know, always the risk. You know, is it gonna pan out with a startup? You know, it was better before 1999 and 2000. It was much better than after for startups. But you know, Design Intelligence, where I went. Back in 95 was a startup, and it was a great idea, you know, because it was an example of this kind of thing where you say, gee, we've got the horsepower, why don't we do something to make a designer's life easier and let the documents adapt to different conditions instead of this one-to-one correspondence system that we've set up.
Yeah.
And we were the first person to use an embedded HTML control, because we figured out that, and this is again custom, we did focus groups before we wrote Lonico. We did sketches of what we wanted to do and focus groups on it to see what people thought in two different cities. And one thing also was saying, well, when people make a document, because we would say, okay, we've got these designs built in, now we're selling to the end customer, and saying, hey, you know, people make documents in different ways. Some people, they just throw all their content in, then they worry about formatting. Other people were the reverse. They worry about the formatting first, and then they put their content in particular places. So we set it up so you could do it either way.
Yeah.
Whichever one you wanted. And, in fact, you would click on this HTML toolbar sitting there and says, oh, you want to gather content? Click this. We'll show you all the shortcut buttons to do your content gathering. Oh, you want to format? Well, click this, and then you got that. So it was saying we wanted to provide each of them ways people would use the program, but we didn't want to set up the white screen problem, which is where you throw up a white screen and there's nothing there but a bunch of obscure toolbar buttons for every possible thing you want to do, and the user's lost saying, God, what do I do?
Yeah.
And so we put that there to be able to kind of have a help system on the side saying, here's what you can do. Yeah. But that was a lot of fun. I learned a lot about design. I've got a whole, that kind of stack up there on the top is just copies of Time and other magazines looking at how they've changed their style and analysis of their style. So these are just all design examples that I would gather and talk over with another designer. And say, okay, now why did they do this? And look at how they changed this. Time was really incredible because they just really started changing their format immensely a couple of years ago. And it was interesting to look from this issue to that issue. Hey, look at what they've done. They've changed this. They've changed that. And I start getting the, kind of partially being a designer. A lot of design sense, you know, that I didn't have coming into it. So the kind of thing is you learn a whole new area. You are understanding the customer, which is great. You're trying to figure out the problem. It's the puzzle. You know, you're trying to figure out a model for something and then see whether they understand it and then see whether you can implement it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And startups kind of give you that opportunity, you know, if it's the same idea. You know, if you grok on the idea saying, yeah, this is something that's really neat to me, then you've got a lot more power to explore. In a way, if I had stayed at Microsoft instead of leaving, I wouldn't have near the experience I do have.
Yep.
Because, you know, you get big company, you know, you do this area. Whereas, you know, go in Asymmetrix, it was, okay, yeah, we did a Lisp interpreter and a Lisp system, and then we're doing a business system on top of that, and then we did this thing called Toolbook, and did a compiler on that. And so just a lot of variety of experience that I got there, and then more at DI. And you grow from that. You learn from that that you wouldn't have necessarily otherwise. So, you know, startups can be great.
If you were going to join a startup today, what would you be looking for?
Something, to me, you know, something revolutionary for customers. You know, something that really hits a need, something you recognize, saying, God, why hasn't somebody done this? You know, you can just feel that there's a vacuum out there for it. Because that's the kind of fun, you know, really, the fun is, you know, when you find people really glom onto something, they really like it. That's really fulfilling compared to, oh, yeah, it was funny, it used to be at in the early days of Microsoft, I can do that in 3 bytes less than you. You know, coding assembler. That's a little too fine compared to where it really is now. It's the market you're trying to hit. And so, yeah, we used to do things like, there were multi-byte instructions, and so we were doing things called looksy tricks. LXI was the instruction, and so what you do is you write an instruction that ended up being garbage, so you put another label in here and come in through a multipath and have it skip over it. So you do this no-op instruction that gave you 2 bytes to do something. So often you'd have something that would, you know, this would do some operation, say carries clear, and so you'd do a jump carry, which you knew wouldn't happen. So you had an alternate entry point that came in here, which would clear something that was set there. These were really arcane. But, oh, I saved a byte because I didn't have to do a jump around. You were saving jumps.
Yep.
Because jumps cost 2 bytes, and you only got 64K total.
Yep.
I mean, the original assembler was like 16K.
Well, there's still those kinds of challenges in computing. You know, when I visit the MSN search guys or, you know, even...
Scale. Yeah, scale is what they've got. You know, we got, 100,000 queries coming in. Let's get them done.
Yeah.
There you got, the little bit makes a difference.
And you can see where... Companies, I'm watching the blog search world right now, and companies just go off, their service goes away for half an hour because they just can't keep up with the growth, because
the
number of blogs are doubling every 5 months. So at some point, that doubling catches up with
you. Yeah, because performance isn't and the invested equipment isn't.
So you need
either.
A big breakthrough to keep up with that, right? And that's not easy to come up with, is it?
Yeah. Well, a lot of ways when I, when I think about a problem, it's the first thing I do in some ways is that I forget everything technical about it. You want to get, what are the original goals and needs? Worry about that first. Then worry about what it takes to do it and what's possible. Because otherwise, you've corrupted yourself. You're trying to squeeze something into an existing implementation you have or existing thought you have without fully knowing what it is. And in doing so, you put a square peg in a round hole. Well, you shave stuff off the sides, and you're assuming that stuff's not important. And often it is, and often it makes the difference between success and failure.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. Talk forever. I have so many subjects. I have my cartoon characters.
If you were teaching a class, what would you teach it on?
It would either be customer focus. I've given a talk to the Windows Developer Bootcamp when we bring in new Windows developers. So I gave one on customer focus and ruts of development and kind of experiences I had, which was fun because it was, it was kind of the feeling of saying, what was posed to me was saying, okay, we've got these new people coming into Windows. What would you like them to know?
Yeah.
And so I used enemy technology as the example.
Okay.
I used the iPod.
Yep.
A good old trusty iPod.
On this side. The lighting sucks.
Yeah. There you go. Yep.
Yeah. I used the iPod as the example because I bought one. I looked at a lot of different players at the time, and I wanted enough capacity because I was saying, well, gee, I'd like to be able to have like all my CDs on this, instead of that huge pack and my 100 CD changer at home. It's so much better just to, have it on something like this. But then, I'm carrying around. So that little, eighth of an inch, that's a big difference. Yeah, I'll pay $100 premium to shave that eighth of an inch off because nothing else was there that had the capacity or the size that the Mac did or the iPod did. And if you look at what they've done, this is the second one I've had. The first generation had the buttons here.
Yep.
Then they've changed to this.
Yep.
There's a real advantage to this, and the slide wheel was kind of, this slide was kind of ridiculed when it first came out.
But isn't this ironic that we're talking about a competitor's product here?
You need to know, you better know what competitors are doing. You better look at their good ideas and the good ways they think and take advantage of them. If somebody's going to tell you, hey, this is a good thought, hey, it's a good thought. Not invented here isn't the best thing to have. You have to be broad. And so when they move those from here to here, well, the difference is I can have this thing down in my pocket. I can be holding it like this, not even looking at it. Turn up the volume and down. Real simple.
Yeah.
natural. Backwards, forward, backwards, forward, play, stop. These buttons are now in kind of a physical location, whereas before you'd be coming across the top and you'd be feeling with your finger to see which one you're on and remembering what order they were in. Not now. It's obvious what those are. And great improvement. Then the next thing they did the smaller 5-gig version.
Yep.
Well, that's for the people who don't need everything.
Or have smaller music libraries.
Smaller music libraries, or they really don't need everything on at once. And size was a premium to them, and so it was just like this, but smaller.
Yep.
But what's really the radical step, and it's something we don't do, is this.
Yep, I have one of those.
You bet.
Steve Rubell sent it to me.
Well, the thing about this,
yep.
It's an incredible thought when you think about it, because they say, what did they do? They radically reduced features. They radically reduced capacity to address a market, which was the market of people, you know, out jogging, walking, whatever, who just needed a few hours tunes and then would refresh it. And they were smart about it, so they made it, hey, how many players have this? And then you think, this is, I just love.
Yep.
Just pull it out, snap it on, you know, put it in, recharge it, put it in and put new tunes on it, and it attaches. So just putting that there, this is clever.
Yep.
It's inventive and it's clever, and it's a good...
I wrote about this on my blog, and to me this is a computing device that is no longer a computing device. It's fashion. When I first got it, I saw, man, this is... Something
it's functional.
Different. Right.
It's functional. Say, it's really functional addressing a market niche.
Yeah.
To say, yeah, you know, these people, they don't need a display. There's no display here. There's not a lot of buttons. There's two. Power on and off. First the shuttle play, and then, you know, volume, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's recognizing...
All right, Steve Jobs, we're gonna charge you for this advertisement.
Yeah. Hey, you recognize good work when good work is done, and that's one thing you say about Apple, is that they're not our size, they don't have our market. They do a lot of good thinking, though.
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, give people kudos where it's due. I don't care if it's Microsoft or external. You know, good ideas are good ideas, and it doesn't matter where they come from.
Right.
And more attention on our part.
I keep expecting Steve Ballmer to come through that door.
No, no, no.
Go, hey.
Hey, we have good ideas. We have great stuff. I'm not saying Apple's the one to do it. I'm just saying it was a great example for that talk to give saying, hey, look, how often, you know, do you see kind of radical reduction in functionality to address a market? They were pretty smart to do that. And, you know, more of our thinking that way, you know, more of our, say, addressing our customers, getting a little away from the engineering mindset. More features is better, you know, it's the Swiss Army knife syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, you just want a knife, and you're going, okay, yeah, which blade, yeah.
There's a company named 37 Signals, which is making that their whole marketing mantra, basically, which is, you know, fewer features done well with fewer employees. Even they want small teams because the small teams
they can react and they can communicate with you. That's the thing with a large team, you know, it's very hard to get communication across, you know, across thousands of people. That's not as easy as, you know, when you get everybody in a room. I can't really get, you know, 30,000 people in a room and talk to them. It's a little difficult. So we have video talks and such. I recommend to any developer. The books, if they can find this one. This is one I first read back in the 80s that really changed.
Donald Norman.
Donald Norman is really a smart guy, and his first diagram here explained to me very clearly, and I put it to heart, you know, how you can make software work well, that on one half, got a user, on the other side you've got the application, you've got how does the user figure out what to tell the application to do something, on the other half you have how does the user figure out whether it's actually done, and when those gulfs are large you've got problems. And another way to put it is, if the conceptual model of the system is the same as the conceptual model of the user, you're not going to get much frustration. Even if you've got a lousy interface, people will be able to find things and do things, because at least when they do it, it'll be what they expect. When it isn't, it's a problem. So I highly recommend Donald Norman. I read that this book in about 3 or 4 chapters out of that many years ago, and took it to heart, and the design intelligence experience better burned it
in
farther.
I see you have Alan Cooper on your bookshelf.
Oh, God, I got lots of things. I got Cartman on my bookshelf.
Yeah.
I've got Cooper. This was from the text document days. So this is Typographic Style, a great book on why designers use certain font sizes, column widths, lettings, fonts. Jacob Nielsen. Lots of Donald Norman. So emotional design, term signals, facial expression. There's a lot. These are, you know, not software oriented, but they use enough real world examples that you say, hey, yeah, why? Think about this. There's a lot of corollaries with what we do in software, and some of the physical examples make it pretty clear. And then products. So this is iPublish, which was the design intelligence product. Things on logic programming, interaction, constraint systems, prologue. Where's the tool book here somewhere? Yeah, I just have a... I got a tool book here somewhere. Just the manual.
Yeah.
Boxes at home. But yeah, a lot of... So I have a lot of books on a lot of different subjects, from programming languages to... domain driven design with some... Wisdom of Crowds, which is another kind of book we're taking to heart right now. So we're looking at ways that we can mine our own internal people and external people. Safeware? I'm getting into it.
How's that book?
A lot of examples of software failures and such. So it's there's a lot of different things to read. This was recommendation from a Bill Buxton talk, who's another good guy. He was drawing parallels. It's on ResNet. He was drawing parallels.
ResNet is our intern.
Okay, yeah, that's right. We're MSD. Yeah, you guys won't see that. But look on, I think it's Bill Buxton.
It's one of my favorite perks of being an employee, by the way. Is all these really great speakers coming.
There is a public version of that. I think his site is BillBuxton.com. That's BUXTON, and there is a version of the talk there where he's talking about parallels between software design and automobile design and movie storyboarding, talking about how much they have to go into it, how much detail they have to go into to do their thing versus what we do, and it's an interesting parallel.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thank you for spending an hour with us.
Oh, no problem at all.
Awesome.
I could
it's an honor to
spend a lot of time. There's so many subjects.
Oh, man. We'd love to get you drunk someday and get some high school stories.
Get out of the bar somewhere.
Get some high school stories, because we're going to interview Bill at some point. So we need some good stories ask him about.
Let's see.
What's a good interview question for Bill?
Oh, no. I was just thinking of some things from high school. You can games we used to play then were, I don't remember how good he got at Go. But he played Go a lot with another guy at high school, and we all played bridge. So, you know, is the thing about Bill and bridge. He's played bridge since high school, guys. We started then.
And was he a good player back then?
Yeah. Bridge is an interesting game.
What is it about his mind that lets him see things or like play bridge? What was it even back then that you saw in him?
Well, it was with a lot of us in that, you know, you just have a very quick mind, you know, in a way a sponge. On things, you know, it's like I pick up new interests all the time. You know, God, Amazon loves me, and the internet loves me too. You know, a new subject. Oh, you know, do an MSN search on it, and or go to Amazon and buy books. So it's just information availability. But you know, it's kind of having that mind where you have that curiosity about things, and you'll dig in, and you'll be able to retain the information and. Yeah, you know, it's great to be around people like that.
Yeah,
really, because you can bounce through things so fast. I'm kind of I'm more kind of visionary than rigorous in a way. So I always liked working with somebody who's rigorous. So I'd have some. Here's how I would do it. You know, design up here. What about this problem? Okay, I do it this way. You know, so you'd have somebody, you know, to kind of be your fact checker, you know, in a way. It could be an interesting mix. And that's the thing as developers you've got to learn is that, you know, everybody's got different talents, different strengths, different weaknesses, and sometimes the mix makes a great synergy.
Yeah.
And you've got to have not so much ego that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, to where you're resenting people.
Apple was Wozniak and Jobs, right, in the early days, and Gates was... How did Alan and Gates, why was it important for them both to be here to have Microsoft happen?
Oh, yeah, because actually it was, Paul was pushing, you know, to go down to NITS and let's go. You know, Paul's the one who brought the Pop Electronics with the author and they said, Bill, we got to do this. That was Paul.
Interesting.
So it's kind of an interesting combination between the two at that point, you know, to kind of feed off each other and, you know, and get it done. So again, you know, each one had their own values. You know, both great coders, but you know, Bill was much more on the business side, but Paul was a lot more at seeing the opportunities, and so it made a great synergy. And you know, that's the thing. You know, you've got to be able to, you know, have people together and, you know, and realize each provides their own value, and you know, the sum is greater than the parts.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Cool.